Hi, and welcome to my podcast, Jack to the Future. From science and inventions to pollution and recycling, I talk about what's changing in the world, the future, and how we can help with that. Every month, I'll talk about a different future theme. For example, the future of science, tech, sustainability, reading, music, and all sorts of other ones. The future of everything. Did you know? You can find me on Facebook and Instagram as Jed to the Future and on YouTube as Jack to the Future. Follow me to get behind the scenes info, access to the previews about my next episodes, and much, much more. Hello everyone, and Happy New Year. We can still say that, right, even though it's the end of January. Thank you for your patience waiting for this episode. Like a lot of you, we've all been poorly for what seems like a long time now. But anyway, I'm back, and today's episode is about the future of evolution. I talked to scientist Julien Delpierre, who works for the Max Planck Institute all the way in Germany, about the possibilities of future evolution. This episode is mainly about humans, but there is a little overlap later on with other species when we talk about natural selection. If you're a child listening, I understand some of the words I'm using sound long and complicated, but do not fear, I'll explain it all. Before I get started, just to say that if you'd like to listen to this episode with subtitles, head over to my YouTube channel and search or use the handle at Jack to the Future Podcast.
So, where did this all start, Jack?
So first up, we're going back in time. Ideas about how animals or plants change or evolve over time date back to the 500s BC. A Greek philosopher called Anaximander noticed that human babies can't do anything for themselves when they're born. He thought that humans might have just come from some other type of creature whose babies could survive without any help. Because fish hatch from eggs and immediately begin living with no help from their parents, he thought that all living things came from the sea, that fish were our ancestors, basically. He was right, you know? But his idea couldn't be proved right or wrong, so it wasn't classed technically as a scientific theory. There was not a scientific theory of evolution until Charles Darwin published his famous book on the origin of species. Darwin and another scientist, Alfred Russel Wallace, proposed that evolution occurs because of a phenomenon called natural selection. Julien will talk about this later on. Fun fact of you, Alfred Russel Wallace went to Hertford Boys Grammar School, which is now Richard Hale Secondary School in my town.
What is DNA, Jack?
DNA is a molecule found in the nuclei, or the middle of cells. What's a cell? Well, a cell is the smallest basic unit of life. DNA is the material that carries all the information about how a living thing will look and work. For example, DNA in humans decide things like what the colour the eyes are and how the lungs work. Each piece of information is carried on a different section of DNA. These sections are called genes.
And what is a gene then?
Like the Lego bricks of all organisms, you build them up and you make a living thing. DNA is cool because it can copy itself over and over again. Its shape, called the double helix, helps it to do this really well. It looks like a twisted ladder.
But what's inside of DNA?
There are four different chemicals called bases in DNA. Adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. These four chemicals are repeated in different orders over and over again in each strand of DNA. The order is important as it forms a code that tells cells to make certain kinds of proteins.
Why do we need proteins?
Cells need proteins to live. The differences in these proteins is what makes living things different from each other. It's unique to us as individuals. When DNA works correctly, it helps keep your body working properly. It also allows living things to reproduce and have babies. Sometimes there are mistakes in DNA. These mistakes are called mutations and they can cause diseases and other problems. Wow, it's really clever, isn't it? And to think that all of that is going on inside us and we don't even know. Anyway, it's time to see what Julien and I think about the future of evolution. What do you think the possibilities could be? I'd like to welcome my special guest today, Julien Delpierre. He has a Master's in Evolution, a PhD in Developmental Biology, and works at the Max Planck Institute of Molecular Cell Biology and Genetics in Germany. Wow, that sounds really interesting. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
You study the liver for a job. I watched a video on the Max Planck Institute website and the lab looks really cool with all the equipment, but a bit complicated too. Can you explain in a really simple way what you do in your job?
So I'm a scientist. I'm a biologist. So I work on trying to understand how biology functions at a very, very tiny scale. I'm looking at how molecules that are inside the cells, named proteins, are interacting and organizing themselves in space and in time in order to give rise to more complex structures and bigger scales. Like, imagine if you have extremely small things that interact with each other in a certain way, they would little by little build something bigger that is itself organized. And then this something bigger would then interact with other structures in order to build up bigger and bigger structures. And that's how we go from a molecule to a cell, which is a small compartment within an organ, to an organ itself. My work is focused on how this happens during development. So I work with mice, and I'm looking at how the cells in the mouse embryo are working together in order to build the liver. Was it clear?
Yeah. So basically building organs for people to like test with out of cells, which are made out of proteins. Is that, yeah, cool.
I mean, not only proteins, but that's what we look
at. Yeah. What is evolution?
Evolution is something we tie to our definition of what is life, basically. In the way we define a living being, one of the criteria is that its capacity to evolve. I think the simplest way to pitch evolution would be the capacity of a living form to adapt to its environment and transmit this adaptation to the next generation. There is the notion of genetics in the concept of evolution, because that's the information which is passed on from one generation to the next, is the DNA. What happens is the DNA, when it goes from one generation to the next, is going through extremely small changes, random mutations here and there, that most of the time are harmless, sometimes causes problem, and sometimes slightly changes the capacity of the life form to interact with its environment. And in this case, if these changes happen to be beneficial, they will be more likely to be spread further in the population. And slowly, over the course of multiple generations, this gene that has this modification in the genome is going to become more and more present across the population. And that's the process of evolution, basically. It's often tied with what we call natural selection. And one pretty nice example of this, there's this type of moth, which is living in the forests in the UK. They are either white, gray, or black. There's these three variants that are present. And people have realized that during the Industrial Revolution, there was more and more pollution in the area, and the trees that used to be gray were getting darker and darker. And the lichen, which is more white and gray, was disappearing from these trees. As a result, the population of moth went from dominated by the gray variant to dominated by the black one, because the gray ones that used to be hiding on the... Not the trunk, sorry,
the bark.
Yes, they were hiding on them because they were of the same color as the tree and as the lichen. But now that there is no more lichen, they could not hide anymore and were preyed upon by the birds. And the only animals that could hide properly were the black variants. And over the course of only a few generations, the entire population was of the black color and no longer the gray color, because the color of the tree have changed.
That's really interesting.
So that's literally observing the evolution working in context. The individual have not modified during their life their color. It's just the one that happened to be of the color matching the tree survived better. And that's very important to make the distinction. Because when we think about evolution, it's very tempting to think that it's an individual that is changing during his lifetime. That's not how it works. It's the individual that happens to have these characteristics that survive better.
Yeah, I see. Researchers found that men's brains are actually getting smaller. Do you think brains will become smaller and still have the same intelligence in the future?
It's a complicated one. First of all, what do we mean by getting smaller? It's important with this kind of affirmation to look at the time scales, right? If I got the reference proper, I believe that the work that you are referring to shows that there is indeed a reduction in the size of the cranium over thousands of years, right? So if you think about it, that means these humans that had a bigger skull were living 10,000 years earlier. And you can argue that nowadays we are as intelligent, if not smarter, than we were 10,000 years ago. So that's to show that basically the intelligence is correlated with the size of the cranium, but not so precisely. A smaller cranium does not directly mean that the animal or the person is not as smart. So if you take, for instance, the cranium of a mouse, which is extremely small, compared to the cranium of a human, yes, you can say that there is a correlation with the intelligence, but not for small variations. And importantly, we think that the intelligence also comes from the connection within the brain and the folding. You know, the brain is folded, like there is convolution at the surface. And this increases the surface for a given volume. So that means that there is more neurons and they are more packed and they interact more. And therefore, you may not need that much of a volume in order to produce the same capacity.
So you still probably will have the same intelligence, even if your brain gets smaller in size. It's like we used to have big, really big machines to like decode things, like the Enigma code. But now we could put that into a phone, which is much smaller. Well, it would be quite hard technology, but yes, it can still do the same thing, but it's just getting smaller in size, like cameras, kind of. Hair is nowhere near as important as it used to be for survival, because we have houses and central heating now, and the planet is sadly getting hotter. Do you think we will lose more hair in the future?
That's definitely a possibility. I mean, we already lost a lot of our body hair over the course of evolution. We used to be much more hairy. It's very possible that it keeps going. I mean, I don't know if I can forecast anything very specific about this, but yeah, I mean, it's a funny form and it's definitely possible.
Yeah, I think, I don't really know. Maybe we'll get as least amount of hair as my granddad. Maybe, I'm not sure. We were talking about how eyebrows and eyelashes serve a different purpose to other hair on our body. Rather than keeping us warm, they keep things out of our eyes, and that's important.
I mean, they do. The eyelashes are important, even now. It's protecting the eyes, right? Some part of our hair is indeed going to stay. The one we have in the ears, for instance, also have a protective function. It keeps the goo in place in order to protect a very, very thin and fragile skin that is located there. So, yeah, I mean, part of our hair has very important function besides heating, for sure. And this one is probably going to stay. But I mean, the one we have on top of our head, if you think about it, is not so critical.
Yeah, we were thinking about that one. I have done an episode recently on the future of photography. And I talked about how in the future you could be equipped with artificial eyes with camera functions. So, for example, when you blink, you take a photo. Do you think this could be possible?
I know people have very mixed feelings about these kind of things. Like, overall, modifying our bodies is always a very sensitive topic for some people. Purely theoretically, it will be possible someday, most likely. Right now, I believe there are some projects mostly directed to restore vision in people that are either born or that developed blindness over the time. And so the way it works is the eyes actually are a good target for these kind of things, because oftentimes the limiting factor for this kind of prosthesis is the way we connect it to the body. And the thing is, the nerves, the long cells that are transmitting information, either visual for the eyes or to impulse the motion of a limb, these neurons, they cannot regenerate. Once they are broken, they are gone, and we don't know how to fix them. However, in some cases, with the example of the blind people, there might be still the optical nerve, which is running from the eye to the brain, might still be there. And in these cases, I know that there is work in progress in order to connect this nerve to a machine that would send signal directly to the nerve in order to project an image into the brain of people. For the moment, the results are impressive, because just the simple fact that we can do that is amazing. But also, it's to be taken with a word of caution, because for the moment, we can only transmit a very limited amount of information. So we don't manage to project a complete picture fully at full resolution. It's more like shades of black and white, and we think it's very pixelated. So, I mean, there's work in order to develop these kind of things. And if it's not controversial, when, for instance, you are trying to restore a body function that is not working in some people, the example you're taking, the camera in the eye kind of thing, is a bit more complicated, right? Because in this case, you're talking about replacing a body part that is perfectly functional. And that's not necessarily very ethical.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it does sound very cool, but it's not necessary. Whereas using that kind of technology to help people who have damaged part of their body or can't use it for whatever reason sounds much more like worthwhile, I guess.
I mean, it's a matter for discussion, in the sense that if something goes wrong, you've been messing things up big time. But yeah, there is possibilities that are very exciting. I mean, you might have also heard about this Neuralink project in the US.
Yeah, I've heard of that. We talked about that a few episodes ago. Yeah.
Oh, did you? So the Neuralink project aims at miniaturizing electrodes that are implanted in the brain, with the goal to essentially connect the brain to a machine in order to, they claim, send and receive signal from a computer. However, as I was saying, one needs to be a little bit careful with this type of approaches, in the sense that what this technology is very good at doing is reading signals, telling whether if there is electricity passing through the brain in this specific region where you put the electrode. That enables some control and learning. So in a way, you can say, okay, if I think about moving my arm, then the computer will be able to read it and it will display something on the screen. That's what I call reading. The electrode is reading what's happening in the brain. However, the sales pitch from Neuralink is also talking about writing, meaning sending signal to the brain. And this, to my knowledge, is not possible at the moment, and far from it, because the human brain is distributed. Not all the functions are happening in the same place, right? So in a way, if you want to control a computer, regardless of where you place your electrode, you can, as a human, learn to associate the movement with the control that you do. For instance, whether if it's implanted where the brain controls the legs, you can think about moving your leg to control the computer. If it's implanted where you control the hand's motion, then you can think about moving your hand to control the computer. However, if the electrode is implanted where the hand is, the signal from the computer to the brain will only be able to affect the function of the hand. It's extremely unlikely that using implants localized into one region is going to unlock the complete brain-computer interface.
So it would be limited to just that area where the electrode was?
Yeah, most of the research and what's limiting us on this with this regard is how to interface the machine with the body.
Like how it can work together?
Yeah. So in the case of the nerves, we can send signals with the brain. At the moment, it's with electrodes, but there is some non-invasive ways to do it as well. You can think of, for instance, a dialysis machine that we're using when the kidneys are no longer functional. There's also a way to interface the body with a machine.
So you wouldn't have to put the electrodes in the skin or break the skin. I wonder how they would do that.
Yeah, I mean, these are important questions for health. And yeah, it's an intense area of research with very exciting possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it could technically, you could send a signal to your brain. You want to do some calculation. Somebody could say it to you, put it on the machine, and then it would send you a signal to your brain. So you could calculate it really fast and say it quickly. That would be quite advanced.
Like boosting your capacities. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like a walking calculator. I guess there's no real medical need for that.
That might be a different
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's a completely different question. You cannot ignore the implementation as well. Say if you have something so fantastic that it would, like, as you say, greatly improve the capacities of our brain, it's very likely that this technology is going to be extremely expensive and only accessible to very few people. So the amount of inequalities that you would generate by, you know, providing this technology to the world and implementing it not through a healthcare system, but as a product that people would buy. That's honestly, personally, I find it a little bit scary.
Yeah, that would be a bit scary. I wouldn't be able to afford it, that's for sure. Buying intelligence, it does sound a bit weird. But imagine, like, for someone who had a functional brain, but maybe it was paralysed, it could be helpful if the Neuralink could read their mind and talk for them.
Exactly.
Maybe in the future we could alter a baby's genes before they're born so that we could get rid of diseases altogether. Could you explain what genes are to my listeners and how this idea might work?
Okay, so genes are small parts of our DNA. The genes are a small piece of DNA that are located in the nucleus of the cell. It is from this DNA and from this region, so these genes, that we can produce the proteins that we were discussing at the beginning. Essentially, the DNA is like a sequence that encodes the composition of the proteins. It does many more things, but for the moment, let's focus on this. The composition of the protein will determine whether if the protein can work or not. Essentially, there is some diseases that are caused by changes in the DNA that in turn leads to the formation of modified proteins that are no longer functional. And if these proteins are not functional, then some body functions are altered. And this results in a disease in some persons. Therefore, having the capacity to rectify the DNA when it's modified and leads to the formation of bad protein, this would help us to fix this situation, restore a proper protein, and therefore fix the disease from the very core of what's causing it.
That's cool.
I have to say that it's not every disease that is caused by mutation. So it's like a small subset of what we call genetic diseases. So there are some examples that I think are extremely good targets for this type of approach. For instance, Huntington's disease, because the whole disease is caused by only one gene being modified. And we know which modification is causing the disease. Therefore, we have all the information to be able to fix it at the genes level. But we need to be very careful with this for multiple reasons. First of all, if we modify our genome very, very early on in order to change the genome in all the cells of the body that is going to develop and give rise to an individual, then we are modifying the DNA of this person in a way that can be transmitted to his children. So that means we are changing the piece of the genome that can propagate across the entire human population. So it's very important to be extremely careful and to know what we are doing when we do that. Mm-hmm. And to only modify what's causing the disease in order to fix it, but nothing else. When we try to modify the DNA like this, we often use tools that, no matter how precise they are, they can make mistakes. Mistakes happen. In this case, the mistake would be a modification somewhere else in the genome. And that's really, really bad because it can cause another disease to the person, or it can stay hidden and be transmitted and then do something bad later on, several generations later. So we need to be very careful with this. There's been attempts in the past. The first attempt, unfortunately, didn't end well at all. As a result, caused disease in the individual that were supposed to be treated. And that has been a huge blowback on the community. People realize how wrong things can go in this kind of situation. And therefore, the whole field took a step back and started to think more carefully about the tools that we have, what we can do with them, and act with more responsibility. Nowadays, there is a resurgence of this topic. because we have new tools that have been produced. CRISPR-Cas, I guess that's what you're thinking of. That's very well known in the public. I know most of the people explain CRISPR by saying that it's like scissors that cuts the DNA, but it's more than that. The critical thing that we need to be the most careful about, making sure that whatever we do is at the right place in the genome. And CRISPR has the capacity to target very precisely. Again, sometimes it makes mistakes, but it's much more precise than anything we had before. Now, the typical use of CRISPR is indeed to make small cuts in the DNA in order to replace a region, to change the sequence locally by making a cut. We remove one piece and put another one instead. Actually, being able to target precisely sequences also enables modifications that are not in the sequence, this time not by cutting the DNA, which means that we can turn some genes on and off without modifying them. And this can solve other problems, like a gene being expressed where it should not, or being expressed too much. Modifying what's around the DNA locally in order to turn the genes on and off. It's indeed a very powerful tool that brought back the hope of being able to cure genetic diseases. And to my knowledge, there is no trials that are performed at the moment, because again, modifying the genome of humans means that this can be transmitted, and this is something we need to be extremely careful of. But it would help tremendously some people. It's also very exciting. The potential is huge.
Yeah, that would be really cool. It could affect the way they look and the way they feel, because you don't know what's going to happen first try.
That's true.
Nothing bad might happen. You won't do it again. But next time you do it, it could end up really well.
Yes, definitely. But what's more likely to happen first is modification done in a fully grown adult. It is coming with a different set of challenges. Before becoming an embryo and then a baby and everything, we start with one cell. And this cell divides a lot. And when it's that early, when there is only a couple of cells, it's easier to access the DNA and make modifications. In a fully grown adult, where the cells do not really divide anymore, they are fixed, it's much harder to actually access the DNA and modify it. Also, it's important to note that if we use CRISPR-based therapies, either in the adults or infants, anyway, later in life, it's possible to make it targeted in a way that it will only affect a subset of cells, and therefore it's not going to be transmissible to the progeny. And in this way, we might be able to avoid many limitations and fears that comes with gene editing on the embryo. So it does have some applications that could improve the quality of life of people. It most certainly is not going to completely cure diseases, but it's a first step.
Interesting and a bit scary as well. Thank you so much for joining me today, Julian. And I think my favourite part is definitely talking about altering babies. I like that.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure to answer this question. It was very interesting. Thanks a lot for having me.
Welcome.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
That's all we've got time for this month. I've really enjoyed learning about our bodies and the possibilities of the future. Mum will put a link to Julian's contact details and the Max Planck Institute in the podcast description, as well as some links to some videos and articles. Julian's made me think about the sort of practical reality of some of these crazy futuristic ideas. Although they sound cool, is it really what we need? Some ideas could actually be quite dangerous, and I feel like we're kind of becoming guinea pigs or just buying a product as if it were the latest gadget to try out, when in fact it could have really awful effects on our body. Where this research might be helpful is to help people with medical problems. I guess evolution really depends on what happens to our planet and where we live. Let's be honest, we don't know what will happen, but the variety and differences in people's DNA is apparently increasing, so it's unlikely it will look the same in a million years. As long as I can keep the hair on my head and I'm healthy, I'll think I'll be happy. What do you think the future of evolution holds?
Join me next time for another exciting episode of Jack to the Future.